Hello, and welcome once again to the St Albans and District Talking Newspaper, serving St Albans, Harpenden and surrounding villages. This is the News Extra edition for the week ending Saturday the 22nd of December 2018. My name is Steve, and I'm the one who takes all the bits of this programme, tidies them up and sticks them all together. Today we'll have our usual roundup of news stories from this week's Hearts Advertiser. And as this is the week before Christmas, it will come as no surprise that there is something of a Yuletide flavour to proceedings. And we'll also have our selection of interesting national radio programmes coming up in the next few days. After that, we have another in our series of Community Matters interviews with a local volunteer group. Today's music is called Rose Petals and is by Goffby. And so to the news. And our readers today are Angela, Jean, Elaine, and, due to a last-minute emergency, the first voice you'll hear will be mine. Well, yes, this is me, Steve, reading for the first time. And the first story is 30 kilograms safe stolen in raid on city centre eatery. A burglar escaped with a 30 kilograms safe after a late-night raid on a city centre eatery. The thief broke into George Street Canteen on Tuesday night between 11:45 p.m. and 12:30 a.m. after smashing a window with a drain rod, forcing it open and climbing inside. After searching the till, the burglar stole a 30-kilogram safe carrying around £500 in coins, afloat from an event the canteen had run in an office building in Luton a couple of weeks ago. They also threw netting over the CCTV camera after it had captured the break-in and escaped from the building by unlocking the back door. It is believed they climbed in over the back wall of the property, which runs between the canteen and the cathedral, before crossing a yard full of wood and shimmying over a fence. The open door and smashed window was discovered at 2 a.m. yesterday by the butcher. It is believed that someone was in the building until 4 p.m. on Tuesday. Owner Kevin Lee said replacing the window would be expensive as the canteen is in the city centre conservation area. He expressed concern about the effect of the raid on his small business, especially around Christmas. "I'm still a bit shocked," he added. Police were called to the scene at 2:22 a.m. yesterday morning, and a scene of crime officer was sent to investigate. Detectives have asked anyone with information to contact them by calling 101 and quoting crime reference number 41/67286/18. Canteen was set up in 2015 by Kevin and his wife Julie and was nominated for several awards at this year's St Albans Food and Drink Awards. On its Facebook page, Canteen posted, "Unfortunately, due to a break-in during the night and our safe being stolen, we'll only be able to take card payment until we can get to the bank after sorting everything out. If anyone spots a large white safe anywhere, please let us know." St Albans has been stricken with burglaries as of late, with various houses being broken into over the last few weeks. 10 burglaries took place on Monday, December 10th alone, 8 in St Albans, 2 in Harpenden, mostly targeting jewellery.
Hello, my name is Angela, and my first article is headed "New Campaign Group Takes a Stand Against Aircraft Noise." Another campaign group has formed to help St Albans residents have their say about the impact of noise pollution from Luton and Heathrow airports. STAND, or St Albans Aircraft Noise Defence, held its first meeting in Branch Road on Sunday, December the 9th, with more than 50 people attending. Attendees included members of the public, local councillors, and representatives from other anti-noise campaign groups. The campaigners aimed to form a strong group of over 1,000 people, raise the profile of the issue with local and national politicians, ensure residents know how to register complaints, and to participate in aircraft route consultations. St Albans resident Evan Todd, who chaired the meeting, said, "We are starting up the awareness group to make the citizens of St Albans and surrounding areas aware of what can be done to complain about the air traffic noise. Obviously, there are other groups in existence, but we felt there needed to be one that was focused locally." People heard about the meeting via word of mouth and through flyers which were distributed to people living in the area. Evan said, "It's specifically for the flights that are flying over from Luton and Heathrow. There have been changes in the last few years in terms of the flight routes, and there's been much more noise. I've lived here a number of years, and in the beginning, I don't remember there being nearly the same number of flights. I think the fact is there are more and more flights, and more of them flying close to St Albans, and people are really noticing it. There's been a lot of people in the immediate area that have been really impacted by it. Many campaign groups, including LADACAN, Luton and District Association for the Control of Aircraft Noise, believe that noise pollution has got worse since the introduction of the RNAV navigation system in 2015, which narrowed the flight paths and concentrated the noise over a narrower area. St Albans needs to stop being Mr Nice Guy and start complaining about flights, otherwise we'll get dumped on, Evan said. That's clearly what's happened. There are things coming down the pipe that will make it worse if we don't let our voices be heard. That's why we called the group Stand. A lot of people really didn't know that you can complain, didn't know how to complain, and didn't know whether making a complaint would actually do anything. It's really complicated with all the different elements. We're working together with other groups to understand what needs to be done and what the short and long-term plan is, and just adding more voices. Luton Airport is currently preparing for its busiest ever Christmas period, after reaching record passenger numbers in November. More than 1.1 million passengers travelled through the airport, an 11.5% increase on November 2017. Flight Operations Manager James Dontis said, "Noise is an unavoidable part of an aircraft's operations, but we are committed to working with the local community to strike the right balance between the benefits and the impact. We are also making the strongest possible representations to government for a UK-wide airspace modernisation programme, which will increase capacity in the air while reducing the number of people overflown. London Luton Airport already has some of the most stringent noise control measures of any major UK airport, including a ban on the noisiest types of aircraft and night flying restrictions that limit the number of flights and prohibit certain types of aircraft from using the airport." While anti-noise campaign groups believe that the introduction of RNAV worsened the problem, the new route aims to steer aircraft away from densely populated areas like Redbourne, Hemel Hempstead and St Albans. The airport is currently consulting on an airspace change to help lessen the impact of noise, but is faced with challenges due to the current airspace structure over the south of the UK. New measures have also been introduced to delay deployment of landing gear, reducing the noise caused by the drag of planes slowing for landing, which has caused a reduction in noise over communities in Stevenage, Whipsnade and Dagnall.
Hello everyone, this is Jean reading for you. My article is about Luton Airport as well. Luton Airport's three-year transformation has come to an end with the official opening of the newly upgraded terminal. The airport underwent a £160 million development, the biggest in its 80-year history, which will increase its annual capacity by 50%, meaning 18 million passengers per year by 2020. The upgraded terminal features 30 new shops, more than 1,000 extra seats, a new boarding pier, and an expanded security search area. It was officially opened by Transport Secretary Chris Grayling on Thursday, December 13th. Luton Airport official Nick Barton said, "2018 has been a milestone year. We celebrated our 80th anniversary in the summer, and now we have completed our three-year transformation, which brings a host of benefits to passengers. Since the work began, passenger numbers have already increased by 35%.
Hello everyone, my name's Elaine, and my article is also about Luton Airport, but it's taken from the Hearts Ad comment, "What We Think." The launch of yet another group formed to tackle aircraft noise from Luton Airport does nothing to help the already fragmented campaign. Stand, St Albans Aircraft Noise Defence, joins other groups including Stax, St Albans Quieter Skies, LADACAN, Luton and District Association for the Control of Aircraft Noise, and HAIL, Hertfordshire Against Luton Expansion, plus the likes of Harpenden Sky and Save Our Skies. The remit of STAND is to form a strong group of over 1,000 people, raise the profile of the issue with local and national politicians, ensure residents know how to register complaints, and to participate in aircraft route consultations. So pretty much the same as all of the other groups then. Quite why we need so many different organisations, all apparently fighting to achieve the same goal, is not immediately clear. But unfortunately, until they start acting as a united front, then they will never have the weight of numbers to influence the bosses of Luton Airport. One also has to wonder how many of these groups are made up of people who are happy using the airport for business or pleasure and are really only unhappy about the fact that some of these planes end up flying over their homes. If you really want to stop aircraft noise, then the best way of achieving that is not to use the airport at all, as the laws of supply and demand are always going to hold the greatest sway over any business decisions made by LLA. Setting up yet another campaign group on top of those which already exist seems inherently pointless and further weakens existing efforts to curb the noise from planes passing over the district. If all of these disparate groups are serious about posting a credible opposition to the further expansion of Luton Airport and the influx of flights crisscrossing over St Albans and Harpenden, then they need to start working together under one umbrella organisation, instead of wasting their time coming up with yet another contrived acronym.
Ladder Road's parking scheme meets with huge backlash from residents for causing congestion. New parking restrictions in Clarence Ward have come under fire from residents for causing congestion and displacing parked cars to other roads. St Albans Council introduced restrictions on December 3rd forbidding vehicles from parking in Jennings Road, Blenheim Road and Brampton Road, known as the Ladder Roads because of the layout, without a permit. Drivers are now parking in Woodstock Road North and Sandpit Lane, which residents say causes obstruction to the free flow of traffic and creates dangerous blind spots. Julian Tatlock, who lives in Woodstock Road North, said, "All the cars just got displaced, which doesn't solve the problem. Woodstock Road North is quite a busy through road anyway, so it creates more of an issue. Only one car can go forward at a time, and it just causes congestion, and visibility is poor at junctions. It's not just very well thought through." Another Woodstock Road North resident, who did not want to be named, said, "It is very difficult for people to get out of their drives. I can't reverse out of my drive because I'm blocked all round. They're just creating a different set of problems in a different road." Controlled parking zones are introduced by the council at the request of residents and after a consultation with affected households. Councillor Sally Gay-Gushush, portfolio holder for Community Services, said, "Residents are able to make a formal request for parking controls when supported by their local ward councillors. The council then carries out a statutory consultation, which is part of a democratic process. This statutory process was followed in the case of the Ladder Road scheme, where the majority response was in favour of controls. There was an opportunity for people to raise any objections to the scheme that they might have, and we placed notifications of the intended scheme on signs and lampposts, which is a requirement of the consultation process. In the case of the Ladder Road scheme, we intended to carry out a full review once it had been running for 6 months. This would enable us to fully understand how the scheme is operating and identify any measures which may help support traffic management. However, residents may formally petition the council before a six-month period to ask for a review of the area if they wish."
We have a letter from Peter S. Norman of Brampton Road, St Albans. And the letter is headed, "What are benefits of parking scheme?" "What a lovely present for Christmas. Councillor White and the two other councillors for Clarence Ward should be congratulated in forcing through a ladders parking programme at this festive time. The effect of this ensures the commuters who used to park their cars in this area have now to walk at least another half a mile to and from the station, which will help to improve their fitness after all those mince pies. This action has already clogged up the through routes to the city in the roads outside their ward. As a county councillor, he should be considering all those in St Albans and district, not just those of his local council ward. We now have wide roads, such as Jennings Road, clear of all cars for the majority of the day, which is becoming a racetrack, completely negating the stated purpose of the restrictions, which was of improving road safety. On the debatable number of those in favour of the scheme, we now have to pay for any visitors to our homes at the rate of £1.30 a visit, equating to 65p per hour, in addition to the annual fee for our own cars. Please could he tell us of the benefits of such a scheme?
Now an article about a pedestrian crossing. Cotton Mill Crossing will stay open thanks to a campaign from St Albans residents Network Rail has announced. The crossing, located between Griffith Way and Cotton Mill Lane, will instead be adjusted to try and reduce misuse. Managing Director for Network Rail's London North Western Route, Martin Frobisher, said, "Public safety at this crossing remains our primary concern. In light of strong public opinion, we are halting plans to close Cotton Mill Lane crossing. We will continue to work with Hertfordshire County Council and St Albans District Council on a safety campaign with the community to ensure the crossing is as safe as possible. The safety measures Network Rail will be introducing at the crossing include straightening the crossing to remove the skewed approach, installing new fencing to turn users in each direction before crossing, renewing the crossing surface to reduce the risk of pushchairs and wheelchairs becoming stuck, highlighting the danger zone with a bright yellow crossing surface, drawing attention to the crossing decision point with white fence posts and ground marking, improving the gates so they self-close while remaining appropriately weighted, retaining the 20 miles per hour speed restriction to the railway over the crossing." There you are, that's what they're going to do. Network Rail will also be running a safety campaign and monitoring the crossing. Users of the crossing are being asked to remove their headphones and hoods in the future. Cabinet members for Highways and the Environment for Hertfordshire County Council, Phil Bibby, said, "We welcome Network Rail's announcement to halt plans to close the level crossing at Cotton Mill Lane. After receiving a petition signed by more than 1,600 local people calling for the crossing to be kept open, I wrote to the chief executive of Network Rail and copied in Jess Norman's Member of Parliament, Minister of State for the Department for Transport, calling on him to halt plans to close the crossing. We welcome the opportunity to work with Network Rail and local people to ensure the crossing is as safe as it can be and still remain open."
Fly tippers dump waste on woodland path and fridges in the middle of the road. A pile of waste dumped near Hartwood Forest and a stack of fridges left in the road are the latest fly tipping scourges to blight the district. Wood, metal, bin bags, a split tin of white paint and other materials were left on a pathway leading to the Sandridge Forest on Monday evening. Site manager for the Woodland Trust, Luke Shenton, said they are working with the local authorities to clear it as soon as possible. He added, "We're sorry to hear that Hartwood Forest has fallen victim to fly tippers. Sadly, litter and vandalism is a common problem on our estate, and we waste both time and money clearing up after other people's mess. If more people disposed of their rubbish responsibly, we could focus resources on planting trees and protecting woods." Meanwhile, 13 commercial fridges were left in the middle of Nightingale Lane behind Nuffield Health, Fitness and Wellbeing Gym in the Highfield area of St Albans. This is the third time this year that fly tipping has had to be cleared from this site. Cones directed traffic round the white goods before they were removed. As the fly tip is on the road, it is the responsibility of Herts County Council Highways contractor Ringway. Ringway Divisional Manager Kevin Carroll said, "The latest fly tip here, which consisted of 13 commercial fridges, was due to be removed by our specialist waste contractor on Tuesday afternoon. Sadly, fly tipping happens far too often across the county, and our teams work hard to keep Hertfordshire looking clean and tidy." He stressed that fly tipping is a criminal act. "I'm sure the vast majority of traders who use the trade waste sites to dispose of their waste properly feel as outraged as we do at the criminals who dump waste irresponsibly. This behaviour diverts valuable resources from the delivery of frontline services at a time when the council must continue to make efficiency savings. Anyone who spots fly tipping taking place should contact the police on 999. Anything discovered after the event should be reported to SADC. If the fly tip is blocking a road, report it to Hertfordshire Fly Tipping."
Stolen bike replaced. An 83-year-old man who had his bike stolen was given a new set of wheels by a St Albans charity. Pensioner Leslie Roberts had his bike stolen from allotments in Richardson Close in London Coney on Tuesday, October 9th. PC Steve Whittaker, who recently joined the London Coney, St Stephen and St Albans East Safer Neighbourhood team, said, "Mr Roberts, who is aged 83, was so upset to find his bike stolen as he relies on it to get around and it helps him keep fit and healthy. We tried to trace the person responsible, but without any CCTV or any leads, unfortunately, we have been unable to get his bike back." The new bike was donated through Age Concern St Albans earlier this month. PC Lauren Wilson, who has also recently joined the team, sourced the replacement bike, which was serviced and fitted with new lights. She said, "Mr Roberts was over the moon to get a new bike. We've already seen him riding it around London Coney. It is never nice to be a victim of crime, and we hope this gesture has helped reassure him that London Coney is still a nice place to live."
And now for a feature on Luton Who, which is headed "Milestone Anniversaries for Prestigious Mansion House Highlight Restoration Work." It's 10 years since Luton Who Hotel and Spa first opened its doors to the public, but the story of how this 18th century Grade 1 listed mansion house became one of the region's leading luxury venues dates back much further than that. Struggling with the weight of debts left in the wake of her husband's suicide, Lucy Phillips, the estate's last private owner, had made the unenviable decision of putting the Luton Who estate up for sale in 1997. The £25 million deal included the dilapidated stately home, 1,550 acres of parkland designed by the renowned Capability Brown, a 50-acre lake, and more than 46 other houses and cottages. But it wasn't until January 1999 that the house was finally sold to the Elite Hotels Group, who immediately faced the arduous task of renovating and restoring their new acquisition, which had suffered decline throughout the 20th century. The mansion was suffering from blown stonework and extensive dry rot. Ornaments in the gardens had been damaged or stolen, and many of the beech, oak, chestnut, cedar and lime trees which were found in the parkland were in decline. The finesse of the listed interior also meant they were only able to accommodate 38 bedroom suites out of the mansion's 400 rooms, and the landscaping of the grounds restricted any additional building work. Over the next 9 years, and with close scrutiny from English Heritage, work took place to not only transform the estate into a profitable venue, including a five-star hotel, leisure centre, golf course and conference facilities, but also preserve its original features. Not only was it necessary to understand the value of the Luton Who's heritage, but more importantly to preserve that character at all costs. It was a phenomenal project, which required 175,000 metres of cabling, 1 million new bricks and 50 tonnes of lead on the roof, but also saw the resurfacing of 50,000 square metre of roads and driveways and the restoration of 27 chimney stacks. The 144-bedroom hotel was officially opened on April 11, 2008, following a £66 million restoration, which included the planting and coordination of 30,000 trees, the transformation of the former stable block into a country club, and the construction of the self-contained conference and banqueting suite at Warren Weir. Today, the heritage and legacy of Luton Hoo is evident throughout the estate. You're walking in the footsteps of such luminaries as the Queen and Prince Philip, Winston Churchill, Queen Victoria, Queen Mary, and Margaret Thatcher, through halls and rooms that each tell their own story, from the former Romanov Chapel through to the staircase based on one found at the Ritz Hotel. But no look back on the legacy of Luton Hoo can be complete without a mention of the estate's place in cinematic history, with appearances in the likes of Eyes Wide Shut, War Horse, Enigma, The World Is Not Enough, Wild, and The Importance of Being Earnest. But it was Four Weddings and a Funeral, which is perhaps the most well-known film featuring the house, with the cast seen in the ballroom, pilloried hall, pink bedroom and terrace, and Hugh Grant hiding from amorous newlyweds in a closet found in the Lady Butter suite. From the award-winning Werner restaurant, through to the grandeur of the great hall, from the exquisite suites to the Italianate drawing room, the sensitive restoration of this prestigious building is evident throughout, a testament to the care and attention bestowed upon it over the past two decades. And there is a picture of Luton Hoo looking very imposing and grand, this lovely mansion, and with the lovely steps leading down to the formal gardens at the back.
Well, the heading for my piece now says even more delightful displays, but from businesses across the city. And here we go on the verbiage for that. Although Christmas Day is less than a week away, there are still plenty of window displays yet to be unveiled for the St Albans Advent Trail. The Advent Trail, supported by the Hearts Advertiser and Radio Verulam, and run by St Albans BID, sees a daily reveal in the window of one of 25 participating organisations. The team at Empire Records in Heritage Close unveiling a vinyl-themed window for their display, and owner Marina Desclavis said, "It's beautiful, it's really fun, it looks magnificent and represents us, and it's simple and true Christmas for us. It's all about music, like everything else. We like to do things handmade and from the heart, with products we already have around. It is my baby." She has been thinking about the design for about 2 months, and it took her 6 hours to create. SA Law Marketing Manager Victoria Thompson said, "It was a team effort. We've always done a nice big window displaying for Christmas. We wanted to make a bigger splash this year, and we've also had some new neighbours in our building, so we've done it all together. This year we've got the SA Law Elfie, where children colour in an elf picture, and we give money to small acts of kindness." Director of Rumble Sedgwick, Alistair Woodgate, said, "I'm really pleased. It looks great and I hope it will raise a few smiles as people walk by. I had to have a house theme as a chartered surveyor and property business, so I thought we would do a village scene at Christmas. Christmas in the snow with lights and all the reindeer. We have a little post box topper which encloses the polar bear plunge this year, which I am signed to do with my colleague, and Nutcracker to hark back to BID's event last year." The district council unveiled their window on Tuesday with a team of 10 people, taking a week to complete the display. Lorraine Dawson said, The inspiration was to showcase some of the beautiful buildings we have in the district, and we better have a better way to make them into a Christmas scene with Christmas lights and sparkle. We had a great team of people with lots of creative ideas and energy. We wanted to do a good job for the council window. Christmas is very busy for the council in particular, and serving customers is our first priority. It was a lot of juggling to get the project done in time. Marika Koller said, "This area should be showcased." Chef and director of Loft St Albans, Nick Mayle, said, "Our windows are very small, so given the building is over 600 years old and they're not on the road, we decided to dress the entrance and the staircase coming up into the restaurant so people from the road can see the baubles."
Every single penny we collect goes to charity. Busking events raised almost £35,000. A kind-hearted plumber and his team raised almost £35,000 for various causes with a popular yearly music event. Every year since 2009, Dean Rosewarne has organised a Band-Aid Busking Day in St Albans City Centre in aid of Rennie Grove Hospice Care and one other charity, which has included Geach Hospice Care and Camp Hill Village Trust. About 9 musicians perform for passers-by during the day-long event, with bucket collectors raising cash. Apart from year one, which took place by St Albans Clock Tower, the event has been stationed outside Ladbrokes on St Peter's Street. Each year, the betting shop has also contributed towards the causes. Dean has only just totaled the event's 10-year takings. It comes to almost £35,000. The 2018 event raised £2,529, which includes a £1,000 donation from Ladbrokes. Dean said, "The more we raise, the more worthwhile I feel the event is. The whole ethos of St Albans Band-Aid is that every single penny we raise goes to the charities. It is glorified busking. It is all outside. There is no stage, no lighting, therefore no overheads. It is just great live music." Elvis Schmelvis, a St Albans tribute act to the King of Rock and Roll, has performed at the Band-Aid event every single year. The 2019 Band-Aid, which will take place in September, will be in aid of Rennie Grove Hospice Care and Earthworks St Albans, a charity which provides horticultural training for people with learning disabilities. Dean decided to support the centre after meeting a man who suffered significant memory loss after a bike accident, who spoke glowingly about how the charity has supported him. And there's a lovely picture of two Elvis lookalikes with a collecting bucket.
Unseen Mystery Novel by local artist is published as a tribute. Unseen work by a successful artist has been discovered and published by her son after her death. Dina Bryant Duncan first moved to St Albans in 1965, setting up the St Albans Art Gallery in New England Street the same year, in order to exhibit local artists such as Gordon Benningfield and Leslie Ann Ivory. The successful space moved around the city, first to Lower Dagnall Street and then to Spicer Street before it closed in 1990, and Dina retired to Westbury-on-Severn in 1998. She was a painter and writer, publishing a number of books including The Magic Garden, True Ghost Stories, True Stories of Fairies and Angels at the Forest of Dean, Old and New Family Recipes from the Forest of Dean, and Dina's Herbal Recipes. One article she authored, The Spirits of St Albans, was published in Hertfordshire Countryside, and she also appeared on TV 3 times. Before she passed away in 2016, aged 86, Dina's eyesight had deteriorated to the point that she could not write anymore. While scanning through her work after her death, Dina's son, Mark Bryant, discovered an unpublished romantic mystery novel called The Emerald Ring, written up with a typewriter in the 1970s when Dina was living in St Albans, Queen Street. Mark decided to publish the book in her memory at his own expense. He said, "I can't put it into words. I just wanted to finish it off and if I hadn't, it would have been stored and then thrown away. I did not edit it because I wanted it to be her book, as if she had taken it to the printer herself, how it would have been as the previous one was. Mark tracked down the printers and designers she had worked with previously to Tidenham near Chepstow. It has now been printed as a 116-page A5 paperback. The blurb reads, "A haunting tale of romance, mystery and tragedy, when Jane Simpson of Sinclair's, the highly respected London auction house, is sent to Trevigo Manor in Cornwall to value Lord Tressick's art collection, she finds herself caught up in a net of intrigue and supernatural happenings." Mark said he is very pleased with the finished product, citing family holidays to Cornwall as her inspiration. He is happy to sell copies of the limited edition at £5 each, including postal charges. To buy, cheques made out to Park Art should be sent to Park Art, 168 Overhill Road, London, SE22 OPS.
And now for an article on Christmas jumpers. Schools, networking groups and businesses took part in Home Start Hearts Christmas jumper competition to raise money for local families in need. St Columba's College were crowned the winners of the Family Support Charities competition with their picture of the entire prep school and sixth form in festive jumpers and raised £1,035. Home Start strategic manager Susie Moody said, "We'd like to thank everyone that got involved, donated and made it so much fun. The pictures were great and everyone had made a real effort, but one picture really stood out for us and that was St Columba's College." Head of Development at St Columba's College, Jim Lewis, said, "Not only were we able to support a great charity that does such amazing work with local families, but we were also able to honour the work of our founders at St Columba's College. The money raised will go towards supporting a local family who are struggling." And there is a picture of all the pupils of St Columba's College in their festive jumpers. But unfortunately, it's an aerial photo of several hundred pupils, so you can't actually pick out the individual jumpers, but everyone looks as if they're having a great time.
Now, here's a picture of St Albans Cathedral with a friend of mine in front of it, and you may have seen her work without knowing her. A book on St Albans' remarkable trees proved such a success that the author has released an updated follow-up. Kate Bretherton, and there's the picture of Kate, of Norrington End, Redbourne, was inspired to write The Remarkable Trees of St Albans after hearing about 1970s Parks Department worker Paul Arnold, who planted trees across the district based on their historical associations. These included the Cedar of Lebanon in Sempty Yard, planted by Countess Spencer in 1803. On the other side of the abbey is another cedar planted by Countess Spencer's great-great-great-great-granddaughter, Princess Diana. This is not the only royal connection in Butterfield Road. There stands a tulip tree planted by the Queen Mother. The book also details an ancient yew tree in St Botolph's, which was 100 years old at the time Columbus sailed to America. It also features trees from Harpenden, such as the silver cup and the climbing tree in No Man's Land. The updated version of the book, entitled The Remarkable Trees of St Albans Revisited, features two new chapters, Fallen Trees and Trees New to the Book. At the suggestion of readers, it also includes a map of walking routes through Verulamium Park and Batchwood. Kate said, "Trees are such a fantastic basis from which people of all ages can learn about St Albans. Local people often ask me about the tree by the clock tower that was recently chopped down." Oh, she was very cross about that. "Another popular inquiry I get is about the huge cedar tree by St Albans Cathedral, which was planted by Countess Spencer in 1803. I'm really glad to have this book available again because it really was popular. Photographs for both editions were taken by Donato Cinicolo, who has lived in St Albans for many years. Kate said, "Donato is a fantastic photographer. He has a real gift for capturing the essence of beauty and magnificence of trees. He took the trouble to take photographs at dawn or whenever the light was just right for his purpose. It is the photographs that make this book such a joy." The book costs £14.95 and is available at Waterstones and St Albans Museum and Gallery.
And my final article has a wonderful picture of nativity scene with a real baby for the baby Jesus. A London Colney primary school went the extra mile for its nativity play by including a real donkey and baby. St Bernadette's Catholic Primary School held the nativity on Thursday, December the 13th, with a real live donkey and two babies taking turns to play baby Jesus. Declan the donkey was sourced from Ark Farm in Bedfordshire, appearing in both the matinee and the evening performances. Baby Jesus was played by Baby Haley in the matinee and Baby Cillian in the evening, both from families at the school. Head teacher Sandra Lavelle Murphy said, "Comments from the audience were how we brought Bethlehem to London Colney. The babies were true professionals, taking to the stage without any rehearsals. As head teacher, I would like to congratulate the children on what was a truly wonderful performance. An evening where they showcased just how talented and brave and committed they are."
And that's the end of the news. And now, the list of people whose deaths were announced in the Hearts Advertiser this week. Peter Burton. William Dunlop, aged 90 years. Harold Greenwood Iso. David Shepherd, aged 65. Tony Skilton, aged 88. And Brenda Wattler, aged 89. Now, another little bit of our offering from Gothby, and then we'll have our selection of national radio highlights for the next few days. And now for a look at some radio highlights in this coming Christmas week. We start with Sunday, 22nd of December, and a spine-tingling tale of the supernatural. At 2:30pm on Radio 4 is The Haunting of M.R. James. Mark Gatiss stars as English master ghost story writer M.R. James, who, every Christmas, would read a tale to his Cambridge students. But this year, horrific events are echoed in reality. Or how about getting into the Christmas spirit by tuning in to Classic FM at 3pm for the first of two carol concerts from St Paul's Cathedral in aid of the British Red Cross, featuring old and new carols plus readings from actors Joanna Lumley and Jason Isaacs. Opera on 3 at 6:30pm on Radio 3 is a production of Puccini's La Fanciulla del West, set in a mining town during the American Gold Rush of 1849. Minnie, the bartender of the saloon, falls in love with a notorious bandit who vows to turn his life around.
On Sunday, 23 December, at 11:15am on Radio 4, is Desert Island Discs, with comedian and chat show host Alan Carr, this week's castaway, in conversation with Lauren Laverne. Repeated on Friday, 28 December, at 9am. At 3pm on Classic FM is the second of the two concerts of carols from St Paul's Cathedral, this one in aid of the Alzheimer's Society, and with readings from writer Julian Fellowes and actors David Walliams, Carey Mulligan and Ben Miles. Or you may prefer to listen to the second and final part of Oscar Wilde's An Ideal Husband at 3pm on Radio 4. At 5 p.m. on Radio 2 comes Carpenters A to Z, a must for all Carpenters fans, as Graham Norton celebrates their unique brand of music. Then at 8:45 p.m. on Radio 3 comes more seasonal fare with contemporary Christmas carols with the BBC singers.
Now for a look at some of those radio programmes broadcast at the same time on each day of this coming week. Book of the Week each day at 9:45 a.m. on Radio 4 is Blowing the Bloody Doors Off. No prizes for guessing that this is Michael Caine's memoir. The actor, now 85, reads from his book in which he looks back on his prolific film career. Composer of the Week each day at 12 noon on Radio 3 is Heinrich Schultz, born in 1585, and unusually for this period, the composer left plenty of documentary traces. Donald MacLeod examines what these writings reveal about him. Then, on Radio 4 at 12:04 p.m. is A Maigre Christmas. Derek Jacobi narrates each day a classic Inspector Maigret mystery by Georges Simenon. This is repeated at 10:45 p.m.
We come now to programmes for Christmas Eve, starting with Conversations from a Long Marriage at Christmas at 11:30 a.m. on Radio 4. Joanna Lumley and Roger Allam find their plans to spend the big day on their own are in danger of ruin, thanks to the threat of friends calling in. At 12 noon on Radio 2 is Ollie Smith's Taste of Christmas. 2 hours of top chefs, including Prouleth, sharing recipes and tips on creating the perfect festive fare. Ollie Smith has advice too on wine, and for teetotalers, a non-alcoholic punch. Over to Radio 4 at 3 p.m. for a festival of 9 lessons and carols. The traditional service broadcast from the Chapel of King's College. This is repeated at 2 p.m. on Radio 3 on Christmas Day. Then at 6:30 p.m. on Radio 4 is the first in a new series of The Unbelievable Truth. David Mitchell is back with a comedy panel show. This is repeated on Sunday the 30th of December at 12:04.
So, on to Christmas Day. And an audience for the Queen at 11:30 a.m. on Radio 4 has Kate Williams chronicling the many depictions of the Queen on stage and screen. Contributors include actresses Helen Mirren, who was told by Princess Anne that she had got it right, and Claire Foy. A fascinating insight into the training performers receive. Pick of the Year at 12:15 p.m. on Radio 4 with Evan Davis and this year's Radio Highlights. Followed at 1:15 p.m. by Once in Royal David City. Former boy choristers share their memories of stepping up to the microphone on Christmas Eve to sing the first verse of Once in Royal David City at the beginning of the Festival of 9 Lessons and Carols. Or you may prefer to tune in to Classic FM at 1 p.m. for the nation's favourite carol. John Brunning with this year's poll of listeners' 30 favourite carols. Comedy drama on Radio 4 at 2:15 with The Hartlepool Spy, starring Michael Palin, Toby Jones, Gina McKee and Vic Reeves. Followed, of course, at 3 p.m. by The Queen's Christmas Message. Then at 4:30 p.m. on Radio 4 is Great Lives with Matthew Paris, a celebration of film icon Charlie Chaplin. Finally, at 5 p.m. on Radio 4, The Listening Project Christmas Special. Fee Glover and guests reflect on a year of lively conversations involving children.
Boxing Day highlights now, and we start with the curious cases of Rutherford and Fry at 9:30 a.m. on Radio 4. This week, an investigation into The Hangover, repeated at 8:45 p.m. tonight. Comedy drama at 2:15 p.m. on Radio 4 with Lena Marsh, live and shticking. Rebecca Front stars as the Broadway and Hollywood legend, a combination of Lucille Ball and Joan Rivers, who returns to the UK for another farewell show, also featuring Michael Ball and Kevin Whatley. Finally, a treat for George and Ira Gershwin fans. At 6:45 p.m. on Radio 3 is Porgy and Bess, English National Opera's acclaimed version of the compelling story of love and violence.
Now on to Thursday, 27th of December. The drama at 2:15pm on Radio 4 is the final part of the conspiracy thriller entitled Trax Chimera. The moment of truth has finally arrived as Helen is about to give birth. But what lies ahead for the beleaguered doctor? Followed at 3pm by Open Country. At the Lady Bower Reservoir in Derbyshire in the 1940s, a village was excavated and then submerged. After an exceptionally dry year, its ruins are emerging into view. Repeated on Saturday, 29th of December at 6:07am. Then over to Radio 2 at 8pm for Quincy Jones's 85th birthday concert. Another chance to hear the music special celebrating Chicago-born composer and producer Quincy Jones. Or you may prefer Face in the Crowd at 8pm on Radio 4. British-Jamaican photographer Vanley Burke catches up with four people caught on camera at 1977's Africa Liberation Day in Birmingham. The crowd there that day were mostly children of Windrush immigrants, the first generation to be born in this country.
Finally, we come to Friday the 28th of December, and at 11:30am on Radio 4 comes There Was a Young Fellow Named Palin, a quirky exploration of the five-line verse form, with examples of limericks by, among others, Arnold Bennett, W.H. Alden, and of course, Edward Lear. The drama on Radio 4 at 2:15 is Porcelain. Three Irish women are united by loss, of freedom, of mental health, and in one case, a child, in this unusual mix of social issues and the supernatural. Comedy on Radio 4 at 6:30pm with a new series of The News Quiz. In tonight's programmes, Miles Jupp looks back at the best moments of the show in 2018. We end this week's radio highlights with a look ahead to 2019. In Correspondence Look Ahead, Lise Duché chairs a discussion in which BBC correspondents from around the world, including John Sapel, Katia Adler, Steve Rosenberg and James Robbins, talk about the events that are likely to shape the world in 2019. This is repeated on Saturday the 29th of December at 1:10pm.
And now, the next in our series of Community Matters interviews. Rob Pearman talks to Emma Dalton of the St Albans End District Food Bank.
Emma Dalton is manager of the St Albans and District Food Bank. Emma, welcome. Just help us first with a bit of background. This local food bank is part of the Trussell Trust, is that right?
Yes, so that's a national provider of food banks across the UK, and we are part of them. We are the St Albans and District Food Banks, and we are our own registered charity. We have been in existence since 2014, and I've been there since we started. So our first food bank opened in May 2014. We run five food banks a week across the district. We have a warehouse which is based in Harpenden, and then from there we take all the food and everything we need to various locations at different times and different days, and the same days every week, and we provide the food bank service from there, which means that hopefully people don't have to travel so far to get to just one food bank facility.
So where are these food banks? I mean, when are they open? Is it just once a week?
Yeah, once a week. So we have three food banks in St Albans. We have one in Wheat Hampstead and we have one in Harpenden, the Batford area of Harpenden. The St Albans ones, there's one in New Greens, there's one off London Road in Selbarns Lane, and there's one in Cottermill.
People donate food, but is that mainly at local supermarkets?
Yep, so from the collection points within the supermarkets, quite a bit of our food comes from there. Also from schools, local churches, businesses, and that all goes to our warehouse in Harpenden. We have to collect it, so we have a van that goes round emptying all the different collection points within the supermarkets that belong to us on a weekly rota, and goes and picks up from other individuals and schools. Plus people do actually go to our warehouse and deliver themselves as well, because sometimes they quite like to see where it actually goes and what it looks like. Our storage is in the Youth with a Mission site in Harpenden currently, and we have a small unit, it's about 600 square feet, and we operate from there. All the food that's donated is weighed, and that's how we know how much is going in and out all of the time. Then we check that it's in date, because we only offer food that's in date. And sometimes people, if they're clearing out cupboards, things aren't always in date. So it's really important to us that things are in date, and when they're donated, that they've got as long a date as possible, really, so that we can optimise their use. It's all sorted into types, so beans with beans and soup with soup, etc. And then we make them up into food boxes that get transported to our different distribution hubs. 15 minutes before we're due to open, because a lot of these buildings are used for something else all the times before. The boxes arrive, we pull all our bits and pieces out of our storage that we might have there, our paperwork, and then we're good to go. It's all tinned food, tinned and non-perishable food, so long life items, milk, long life juice, cereal, tinned goods, pasta, rice, that kind of thing. Packaged food with a long date. And also we have non-food things that are essentials to living. Toilet roll, toothpaste, washing powder if we have it, nappies, that kind of things. Things that are quite expensive for people to buy, but they need them for their daily living.
Yeah. Why is there so much need locally for these food banks?
We do live in a very affluent area, or an area that's perceived to be very affluent. But actually, we've got a lot of people who aren't affluent at all, who are living in social housing or council housing or living on benefits. And they seem to be hidden away from a lot of people. So it makes it really difficult for our clients to approach us because of that disparity.
Is unemployment such a huge issue in our district as it is elsewhere, obviously, in the country?
It's certainly not as high as it is in other areas. A lot of the people that we see coming to the food bank that aren't able to work are because of some illness or disability or mental health issues. It's not so much lack of jobs, it's them not being able to carry out those jobs.
Now, one of the things I had not realised is that universal credit has already been rolled out across this district, so presumably that has an impact.
Absolutely. So the full service rollout of universal credit started in the district in November 2017. So we are seeing a lot of people who are in that transition period of universal credits when they are waiting for money.
It's that gap, isn't it, between the old system of individual benefits when they come to an end. Universal credit payments haven't started. That can be, what, 5 weeks delay?
Yes, I mean, when it initially launched, it was around 8 weeks wait for money. That time has improved to between sort of 5 and 6 weeks now. So that is an improvement to the universal credit that is currently being offered. But the benefit system before, payments were made fortnightly, whereas now with universal credits, it's paid a month in lieu like a salary. And that's why there's such a big wait. Because also everything stops. So their tax credits, their housing benefit and everything. So nothing's coming in and no bills are getting paid during that period because there's no money.
So do you get more people coming to food banks in areas where universal credit's been rolled out than you do in areas where it hasn't yet happened?
Yes, most definitely. And actually, the Trussell Trust released some information about this on the 25th of October. And they have said that demand for food banks has surged with a 52% rise in food bank use in universal credit areas after a year, compared to 13% in areas that don't have universal credit yet. And what we are seeing is about 60% of the clients that come and see us are transitioning onto universal credits. That doesn't mean we're seeing 60% more people, but we are seeing more people, and a lot of the time the reason is because they're transferring onto universal credits.
And of course, you don't only have people coming to you for assistance because they're without work. There are also people coming who are actually in work.
a phrase that is used is the working poor, and people that are working hard in jobs, two jobs, trying to make ends meet, but cost of living is expensive, rent, food, and sometimes a bill comes in and there's just no money left in the pot for food. If their washing machine breaks down or their car breaks down and they need it for work, when people have to kit out their children for secondary school, the expense is huge, you know, £300-400, maybe more, and they just don't have that money. And if they use that money for that purpose, then there's no money for food and quite often no money for heating or anything.
So someone simply can't survive the several weeks wait between the old and the new systems. The old benefits have been stopped. Universal credit payments haven't yet begun. I understand they can actually get a loan or an advance from the government.
People are very reluctant to take that loan because what that actually means is all those months later, they're getting less money. But obviously, they may not have any choice. And there have been improvements made to that system as well. Initially, a loan was offered and it had to be paid back within 6 months. Now it can be paid back within 12 months. So it's spreading the period that the payments get made, which is great. But it still means that obviously money is coming out at source every month. So people are reluctant to do it because they'd rather try and get by somehow, to know that they're going to have their full payments when the payments do start. People will do almost anything before they come and see us. They'll borrow money off friends and food, and they'll get family members to help. But once all of that help has run out, that, you know, and we are the last resort, and we understand that. So we know people are going to feel very emotional when they come and see us. They can feel angry because of the situation they're in, and they can also feel really hungry sometimes, which affects people's behaviour. So all we can do is just be warm and welcoming to people when they come in, not rush them, give them time, sit and have a cup of tea with them, follow their lead, really. If they get emotional, just let them cry or get everything off their chest. And then hopefully they realise that we're just there to help them, and we give them some help, we give them some food, we signpost them onto some more help, and hopefully we give them a bit more hope back and a bit more power back again. They feel a little bit more in control.
Well, now, in most cases, the people who go to a food bank aren't just walking off the street then, but they've been referred to you by another body or another person, agency. Is that the system you prefer?
The way our models are set up within the Trussell Trust network of food banks is we work mainly on referral. So it's really important that we, and myself as the food bank manager, builds up relationships with organisations locally that can refer people to our food banks. So that could be pastoral care teams in schools, or heads will hold our vouchers, the Citizens Advice Bureau, social workers, health visitors, all sorts of different people within different professional areas that will be hopefully able to identify that people are in need and then refer them to us.
So if somebody hasn't actually encountered any of those other agencies, they can presumably fall through the net.
If somebody was to walk through the door during a food bank session and tell us they were hungry, we would believe them and we would help them in that instance. And during that conversation, during that exchange, we would agree what needs to happen next time if they need us again. It's very rarely just a one-off, although we aren't there to be relied upon long-term either. Our model is set up that we can give 3 vouchers within 6 months, which isn't very much at all.
So does one voucher cover just the one visit to the food bank?
Well, a voucher actually means 3 days emergency food. That is what we give to people. But if they are working with another professional and they've got issues, so they might be working through their debt issues with a debt advisory agency, then we can agree to support them longer term. But it's really important that we try and get to the reasons why people don't have the money for food and try and help and point them towards a solution.
So do you see it as part of your job to help people to find a solution?
Yes, it is part of our role. It's a major part of our role, the signposting that we do. So it's really important that we know who is out there to help people and what options people have.
So not only are people referred to you for assistance, but you may also refer them on to other agencies.
Yes, absolutely.
So you can't actually give someone a continual series of food supplies. Is that because it's a bad option for them, or are you simply not allowed to do so?
Well, it's within our operating guidelines. It's not what we do. But obviously, we treat each individual circumstance as we see it. Because we live in an affluent area, we do have a lot of donations and we mostly have enough food. We can quite often get quite close to running out of food towards the end of the summer holidays when all the harvest most festival food has gone, all the Christmas food has gone, and we're busy during the summer holidays. Sometimes we can only have like a couple of weeks of food left. So I guess we can be a little bit more flexible as to who we support and for how long. But obviously I need to be able to back up those decisions as the food bank manager as to why we're supporting that person longer term and maybe not somebody else. So we've got equal opportunities and we look at each case and we just have to act on what's presented to us.
Do you find an increase in demand during the school holidays when kids are at home and there's no access to school meals and so on?
Absolutely. So one of our reasons on our food bank vouchers is child holiday meals. So the professional can tick that box, especially if children are used to getting a free school meal during the summer holidays or even just half term or Easter holidays. There's no provision given for that meal. They're not given like that £2.50 a day to feed their child during the holidays. So it can make it really difficult to feed their families.
Now, we've had the summer, we've had the harvest, now we've got the winter coming with Christmas and all that that means for families. Is this a particularly busy period for the food bank?
Yes, it's a very difficult time for our clients, really. If we take Christmas, obviously there's so much pressure on people to have an amazing Christmas, give their children exactly what they want, have the traditional Christmas dinner, have the big tin of chocolates, everything. It's really difficult for people. And obviously, we can advise them that the most important thing is that they pay their bills and they pay their rent and they keep their home. But it's very hard for them to not fall into the temptation of spending that money, thinking that it's going to come from somewhere else in January, because they just want to have a nice Christmas like everybody else.
And do you see an increase in demand during the winter months?
Yes, I mean, they're predicting quite a hard winter this year. They're saying could be cold for 4 months. So we would think that would have a significant impact on us and people that come and see us, because they'll be choosing to heat their homes rather than buy food. There's a little phrase, it's heat or eat, and people having to choose between that, which is just not right.
So people come to you because they're in need of your help, but there are also lots of other organisations around the community helping in other ways. Are you involved in working with any of those?
I think it's really important that charities work together and try and support each other as much as they can. So for us, as a food bank, we do supply food to other charities locally. So Open Door is one of them. So any donations that Open Door have and can't use quickly come to us. And then when they need things, so the store cupboard staples for cooking their meals, then they come and get them from us. And that happens throughout the year. We've also supported the Crescent, which is another local charity with food, because they are really struggling for funding and it's really important that they provide meals for people taking their medications. So again, we have happily supplied them with overstocks that we've got of tinned tomato soup, etc. I think it's really important that we all work together and try and tackle things as an organisation, as a group, as opposed to just one person doing this and one person doing that.
Do you think there's a good link between local groups who are tackling local need? You've mentioned a few of them there. Do you think local charities actually understand what the others are trying to do?
I think so. I mean, from our point of view, I would say so. I work really closely with the Citizens Advice and I speak to the supervisors and the manager there regularly and pick their brains on certain things if I don't know the answers. I was just talking to somebody at the Living Room the other day, which is an addiction clinic. They help people with all sorts and I was picking their brains about a safeguarding issue. It's really important that we talk together and share anything that's of use.
You said earlier that someone coming into a food bank can be quite distressed, and it's understandable. And you and your colleagues take time to sit down, have a chat, a cup of tea, but your team are all volunteers, aren't they?
Yes, absolutely. So everybody at the food bank is a volunteer. I myself started as a volunteer. And yes, it's a big thing for volunteers to do. It's a big responsibility. The volunteers that are seeing clients are obviously trained to deal with people in a certain way and ask certain questions. But we're not social workers or counsellors or healthcare professionals. We are just people who are trying to help other people.
Do you have enough volunteers?
We are always looking for more volunteers because retention of volunteers can be difficult, although most of ours have stayed and have been with us quite a long time. The roles are always evolving. We managed to get a van in spring of this year. What we need now is drivers to drive that van. So the needs change and we need to be able to adapt to those for sure.
So there are different roles then, and some prefer presumably to work in the warehouse, sorting out the supplies. Others like to be in the food banks meeting the clients.
Yes, definitely. And people can do as much or as little as they want. So if somebody says, I only want to stay in the warehouse, that is their prerogative. But if people want to try all different areas, then also they can. Obviously, the volunteers who see the clients have to have a significant amount of training to be able to deal with whatever's thrown at them during those sessions.
And what sort of training can that be?
There is a training package provided by the Trussell Trust that I have to take all client-facing volunteers through. There is an amount that needs to be learnt just by observing and watching and shadowing other volunteers. And then there's one-to-one time I need to spend with each volunteer answering any of their questions and checking that they understand what it is required of them. And that is continuous because obviously things change all the time.
Now, you've mentioned the warehouse several times, and I think that's actually one of your biggest problems right now, isn't it?
We've recently been given notice to leave our warehouse premises, and the date we're aiming for is February 2019. Nothing is certain after then, so we really need to find some new premises and quickly. They need to be within the district, if at all possible. It doesn't matter where, but there are certain things that obviously are very important, and one of them is it needs to be easily accessible by road, and we need to be able to get vehicles close to it to transfer all the food and everything. So what we're looking for is a space around 750 to 1200 square foot. So not a huge commercial warehouse so you'd have in the back of your brain that you would see on an industrial site. We just need a small part of that, which again could be an option. Just sharing a small part of something with other charities would be great. Or a building that is around that sort of size that again we can use. We need to make sure it can be free of pests, or we can obviously put things in place to make sure it is. Power and heating is nice, but what's really important for us is that there's no steps or difficulty getting food in and out. And it would be really good if we found somewhere that we could move to and stay for a number of years, because obviously having to do lots of moves is very tiring and very time consuming, and tinned food is heavy. We're talking of maybe moving something like 20 metric tons of food, which is a big undertaking, and then having to do it again at a later point is tricky.
So you need new warehouse space, you need a continuing supply of volunteers, and a continuing supply of donations from all of us.
Absolutely, yep. So we need all of those things to keep coming. The food especially, the volunteers, and obviously we need to raise funds. We need to raise money as a charity to pay our rents, to run our van, to buy things that we need, buy uniform and anything that we need to run our business. We have a lot of loyal supporters who will pay us by direct debit every month a certain amount of money. Sometimes people will raise money for us rather than food, which obviously is excellent. But most of our fundraising is done by applying for grants, so from the local council or the Hertfordshire Community Foundation or any pots of money that are out there that we can be considered for, we as a collective will apply for them.
Well, Emma, thanks very much. I hope it's not too cold a winter, though it sounds like it might be. Thanks for telling us about our local food bank. I wish you and your colleagues well.
Thank you.
Well, many thanks to Emma Dalton. You can find out more from the food bank by going to their website. That's stalbansdistrict.foodbank.org.uk. Maybe you want to volunteer or to support or help in some other way. I'm sure you'll be very welcome. You can also phone 01727 613019. That's 613019. Or email manager@stalbansdistrict.foodbank.org.uk. Emma mentioned the five locations of the district food banks. We thought it might be helpful if I spelled these out together with the opening hours. There are three locations in St Albans. On Tuesday afternoons between 1 and 3pm, the food bank is in New Greens at Christchurch, number 3 High Oaks. It's in New Greens. Also on Tuesdays, but this time between 3:30 and 5:30pm, the food bank is in Cunningham at the Cunningham Hub on Selbarns Lane. Then on Wednesdays, they move to Sopwell, where they're open from 12:30 till 2:30 at the Christadelphian Church Hall. That's at 4 to 6 Abbots Avenue. On Thursdays, they're off to Wheat Hampstead, where they're open from 12:30 until 2:30 at the Hildyke Community Centre. That's at 17 Hildyke Road. And finally, on Fridays, they operate in Batford between 1 and 3pm at the Batford Children's Centre on Holcroft Road. As I said, you can get all this information from the website stalbansdistrict.foodbank.org.uk or by telephoning 01727 613 019.
Finally, we have our piece of music, Rose Petals by Gothby, in its entirety. Many thanks to all our readers today, to Angela, who provides the radio listings, and to Monty and John, who make all the copies of the programme and arrange to get yours to you. And we'll be back again next month. But that's all from News Extra in December 2018. So, on behalf of all of us here at the Talking Newspaper, may I wish you a very Merry Christmas and a happy and prosperous New Year. Goodbye.